You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, after the horrific attack on satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo in Paris this morning that killed 12 people, we'll get analysis and reaction from our contributors Daniela Peled and Robert Fox right here in the studio. Then, a little later in the programme, we'll meet Massimo Bottura, chef patron at Osteria Francescana in Modena, to find out some of his favourite things.
It's beans and pasta, working class heroes. It's not blue lobster or caviar.
And later in the programme...
It's all there on the Gospels, the Magdalene girl comes to pay her respects.
Theatre critic Matt Wolfe will be here to give his top picks this week. All that and plenty more besides coming up here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A busy show in prospect then. Before we start all of that, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News with James Luckhurst. At least 12 people, including four cartoonists and two policemen, have been killed by three gunmen at the offices of Charlie Hebdo magazine in Paris. A major police operation is underway to find three gunmen who fled by car. President François Hollande said there was no doubt it had been a terrorist attack of exceptional barbarity. The masked attackers opened fire with assault rifles in the office and exchanged shots with police in the street outside before escaping by car. They later abandoned the car in northern Paris. European Parliament President Martin Schulz called for unity after the shooting and expressed his condolences to the families of the victims.
We are not prepared here in the European Parliament and nowhere in Europe to accept that these values are attacked as it happened today in Paris. But in the same moment, let's not react with emotion. Let's stick together in defending our values and continue our open-minded society based on our values and our mutual respect.
The euro has fallen to a new 9-year low against the dollar today, with cheap oil driving a bigger-than-expected decline that may prompt the European Central Bank to start printing money. Eurozone consumer prices fell by a worse-than-expected 0.2% annually in December because of much cheaper energy. Chief Eurozone economist at ING Belgium, Peter van den Hout, says the drop in the euro could see the European Central Bank forced to take action.
To get the economy going again, the balance sheet of the ECB probably will have to expand, and the most easy way to do that is by buying sovereign bonds, and that's the reason probably why the ECB will start to buy sovereign bonds in the first quarter and hoping for a positive market reaction, which could also trigger some more optimism, some more investments, and then get the economy going again.
Indonesia's search and rescue agency says the tail of a crashed Air Asia jet has been found upturned on the seabed, about 20 miles from the plane's last known location. The discovery indicates the crucial black box recorders should be nearby. Flight QZ8501 vanished from radar screens over the northern Java Sea on the 28th of December, less than halfway into a two-hour flight from Indonesia's second biggest city of Surabaya to Singapore. There were no survivors among the 162 people on board. Jury selection for the trial of the accused Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev will move into a more difficult phase today after the court wraps up its initial screening of 1,200 candidates summoned to appear this week. The field needs to be reduced to 12 jurors and 6 alternates. Final preparations are underway in Sri Lanka ahead of Thursday's presidential election. 65,000 police officers have been deployed and the army has been placed on alert to provide support if needed. President Mahinda Rajapaksa is hoping to win a third 6-year term and is up against his former health minister Maithripala Sirisena. Even before the vote takes place, with the result expected on Friday, opposition member of parliament Arjuna Ranatunga is claiming there could be electoral fraud.
Going through the entire process, we are getting a lot of information from different parts of the country regarding rigging this election. We won't allow that to happen. We will give our 100% and try and change this entire regime.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is exactly 6 minutes past the hour, 13:06 in New York City. Joining me in Studio One here in Midori House with their take on the news of the day are two regular Monocle contributors. We have Daniela Peled here, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and alongside her, Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard. We'll be hearing from both of them in just a moment. First up, we're going to go to Paris and hear from our correspondent there, Tom Burgess Watson, who's live amid the crowds at Place de la République. And Tom, we were hearing in our news bulletin about the extraordinary and shocking events in Paris earlier this morning. Just bring us up to date with the sort of the mood where you are and the reaction to what we saw earlier today.
Yeah, good evening. I'm just down a side street, in fact, from Place de la République, because the crowds were so vast. The mobile phone signals were intermittent, so I'm here in a rather quieter place, but still going past me, hundreds of people flocking past, either going to or from the protest there, estimates in the high thousands of protesters there, people waving placards, but a very eerie silence. It was a very respectful silence, people standing there in solidarity with each other, really, with the journalists who were killed. And I think really dumbfounded, shocked. Nothing like this has ever happened before. This is the worst terror attack. It has been described as such in France's modern history. So people here profoundly shocked. And the whole way through the day, the metro has been very empty. Shops have been quite empty. People walking around looking rather stunned and, as I said, dumbfounded.
Tom, French President François Hollande was on the scene within half an hour, and he called on his country and his countrymen to remain united. He issued this high state terror alert, and he called the massacre, I guess we saw today, an attack on liberty. That call for unity, is that likely to be met with the kind of unified response that he is asking for? Or do you think that there is a risk? Are there fears of people reacting in a more hostile way?
If this evening's scenes are anything to go by, it seems his calls are being heeded. Indeed, people are, as I said, they're very respectful and standing very much in solidarity, very much united. And I think people understand, the majority of people understand that any sort of counterattack or any sort of use of this tragedy for any other means would be extremely detrimental to the country and to the cause in general. So I think people here are so shocked, and I think that there must be a lot of hope that no political groups and no factions in the French political scene seize upon this as being an opportunity to drive an agenda that they already have. Indeed, as you said, I mean, France on very high alert. The Vigipirate system, which is the flag, if you like, the metaphorical flag they hoist, we're now at the highest level of alert here in Paris on the scale. The level's been pretty high for a while, because if you remember, throughout the Christmas period, there were quite a number of lone wolf attacks carried out by individuals at Christmas markets and so on in various towns and cities. But the scene here in Paris this evening is one of a very unified French people, and that isn't just the scene in Paris, it's the scene in Lyon, in Marseille, and other cities right across the country where, in their own Place de la République equivalent, they're all standing there as the president asked them to do, and in a respectful way, honouring the 14 people who were massacred today, the 12 people, I'm sorry, who were killed today.
Tom, stay on the line because we'll speak to you again a little later in the programme, but let's return to the studio for now and talk about this attack on the offices of satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo. The French president, as we've heard, labelled the attack terrorism. A police union spokesperson described the perpetrators as commandos. Robert Fox, London Evening Standard defence editor, let's start with you. What were your initial reactions when you began to hear the news that was unfolding in Paris this morning?
Well, these things always appear to come out of the blue, and then as time goes by, they seem to be less out of the blue. And I don't mean to be superficial or facetious about this. There are connections, and there are connections which we just don't understand at the moment. The obvious conclusion to leap to, because they had just tweeted an image of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader, the emir, the caliph of the Islamic State, that it could be related to that. But there is a bit of a running story with Charlie Hebdo, because there have been firebombings and so on. We know what we know. It's very interesting that the New York Times tonight has put out on its website, this is what we know and this is what we don't know. And we don't know exactly who these people were. They have not been identified, and we don't even know if the French police know who the three are. And we were just saying before we came on air, Danielle and I were discussing this. It's interesting the rhythm of these stories. Very early on, there was a report that they had a rocket launcher. And then after an hour or two, the rocket launcher disappears from the news headlines, the running blogs and so on, which are the necessary engines of this story. Very interesting reflection. Very much the Brits are going back to 7/7, the Americans and the global audience to 9/11. I do think there are lessons to be learned from that, but we can discuss that.
Yeah, we'll get onto that in a moment or two. Daniela, what about your initial responses? As Robert alludes to, they're very difficult to know with a great deal of certainty, as the facts on the ground still remain rather unclear. But what was your sort of initial reaction beyond one, I suppose, and I imagine of shock initially?
Yeah, absolute shock and horror. And like many other people, I've been obsessively checking social media all day without learning very much new from what we already knew this morning. I think the problem is with the way this is being interpreted. You know, I speak this, you know, just upholding the principles of journalism here. People are assuming a lot, and people are already extrapolating that these are French North Africans who travel to Syria or Iraq and have come back and are carrying out, then trained there and are come back. And this may be true. This may not be true. We simply don't know. And from the videos, the really horrifying videos that have been shown of this, they seem to have some military training. We don't know to what extent. We simply don't know whether they're trained to a commando level or whether they're enthusiastic amateurs. We don't know. But obviously the situation is so fraught and people are so frightened. And with a very, very slow amount of information getting through, as we were saying earlier, we know nothing about the manhunt, for instance. We don't know where it is. We're not even sure whether there are two or three people. So I think people are trying to fill in the gaps, and that's a little bit dangerous.
Robert, let me ask you about this idea of, although, as Daniela says, two, potentially three people, but still essentially this kind of idea of a lone wolf strike, you know, the unpredictable terrorist. You think back to the siege in Sydney last month, people were talking then about how difficult it is to preempt, perhaps impossible. They did seem to have a great deal of calm, speculation, as Daniela says, about, you know, what their training may or may not have been.
Double tap, too.
Well, indeed. But what about the way that these countries, these cities, identify or attempt to identify threats of this nature? Are there any immediate conclusions that people should be jumping to?
You should keep calm. This is the real message. I'm sorry. And it's brought out very strongly in Jack Fairweather's book about how the world went to war in Afghanistan following 9/11. Actually, if you reel back the facts as to what happened immediately after 9/11, the 10 days, the just under 3 weeks before the campaign was launched in Afghanistan, it was pretty darn chaotic. They didn't really know where the thing had been mounted from. And it still is pretty ironic, for instance, that they focused, you know, the brain must have been Osama bin Laden, therefore you oust him from Kabul and you oust him from that regime. The fact is that there was such a strong Saudi Arabian presence amongst those hijackers, the fact that Mohammed Atta had been in Hamburg. It's these sort of things that you've got to pull apart. Very quickly, can I answer your question directly now about lone wolves? I'm getting very scared of that expression now. I think that because it's almost an admission of failure on our part as journalists, as investigators, because what is clear now, and the Sydney attack is a particularly good example, you've got to have a better forensic psychological approach to it. Forensic psychology, forensic anthropology. You need cracker, really, to get into this. But what brought this home to me was Special Operations Command in the US is starting from zero to analyse the psyche, as it were, if there is a group psyche of Daesh, ISIS, for example, because the Major General in charge, very sharp guy, said, I for myself don't really understand it, nor does my immediate team. And there are an awful lot of assumptions. Like Danielle, I've been reading through the stuff. I'm sorry, I won't bang on about it. But the coverage, absolutely, understandably and expectedly, is all over the place.
Mm. We'll talk a bit more about that in a moment or two. I just want to cross back to Tom Burgess Watson briefly before he leaves us. Tom, we've talked about the need for cool heads. We've talked about the need not to jump to rash reactions. Are you confident that in France that's the same message? It is about remaining calm. There won't be any sort of furious calls for immediate and decisive strikes or reactions to what we've seen today?
No, I can't possibly say what's going to happen in the future, but I don't envisage a day when I see people calling for some form of action or retribution or anything of the kind. Just listening to your discussion just now, one point that struck me is the French authorities said today that they had in fact foiled quite a number of potentially catastrophic terror attacks during the course of the last few days. They weren't very specific, but what it sounds to me like, and I think a lot of the French population will be thinking along these lines as well, is that the French intelligence services are good at what they do. This isn't a new threat, and they're working on it. And they have been working on it, and some attacks have clearly some things will fall through the cracks, but they have, they say, foiled some enormously potentially catastrophic attacks in the last few days, meaning that I think the French population has to take stock of the fact that there are professionals, there are trained individuals that are working on this. They are identifying the threats that they can identify, and obviously there are some that simply cannot be identified for whatever reason. But I think people are keeping cool. I haven't heard or seen any expression of hatred. Quite honestly, I've seen expressions of anger from all sides. I've heard, in particular, disgust from my Arabic language colleagues, journalists here in Paris, of which I know a very large number, and they are as disgusted and as horrified as everybody else. And I think it's very clear to everyone's hearing that message is coming across. The Imam of Paris has spoken, saying that these attacks are entirely un-Islamic. They have nothing to do with Islam. And that message is coming out. People, I think on the whole, are going to just have no choice but to keep cool heads and to listen to what the authorities tell them to do. And I think as a tribute to those who've died as well, I think people will feel that it isn't appropriate to start talking about vigilante attacks or anything of the sort. I really don't envisage that happening here on French soil anytime soon.
Tom Burgess Watson, Monocle's Paris correspondent, thanks for joining us on the programme. Daniela, one other potential unwanted consequence of this, of course, is to look at the ostensible target of this, which was Charlie Hebdo, this satirical newspaper that had been unafraid, both recently and over the last few years, to risk the wrath of people, certain members of the Islamic community, by poking fun at that, as they did through a whole number of targets. Do you think there's a risk that there'll be questions now about how the media covers Islam and issues that deal with Islam? Was is one of the objectives potentially of these people to try and interfere with the process of reporting, with the process of satire even?
Well, I'm sure one of the aims of the people who carried out this attack was in the hope that there would be vigilante attacks and there would be a backlash against European Muslims. And I have to say, I'm a little less optimistic than our correspondent in Paris is. However, another thing that I've noticed, I mean, it's very strange watching this whole thing play out on social media, and that has been my major experience of the day, is how much disgust there's been where conventional media outlets, numerous daily newspapers, have reprinted pictures of the magazine, but pixelated images of Muhammad and the images they've seen as offensive. And there's been real outrage on that. And I'm not really quite sure where I stand on this, because I think if they pixelated it originally when this whole controversy happened a couple of years ago, then there's some justification for it now. But I think the media's handling of any issues relating to Islam is already quite problematic. I think we've got it's very difficult to get an idea of what is actually offensive to a community that's as wide and diverse as any other. And I think the people that claim to speak in the voice of Islam are just the people that sort of shout loudest and have got the strongest agenda. So whether a cartoon of a simple depiction of Muhammad is hugely offensive to the majority of Muslims in England or France is very, 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 very hard to know.
Robert, you're talking about reactions, you know, military responses, diplomatic ones, certainly post 9/11, and talking about the need, you know, the lessons we've learned over the decade and a half since of keeping a cool head. What about the media? Because in the aftermath of that campaign, of course, it did tend to be, as Daniela said then, the voices that shouted loudest that gained the most coverage in the media as well. How much of a responsibility do you think there is incumbent upon figures within the media when reporting, when writing opinion pieces or adding their comments to be mindful of that kind of pressure?
Yes, I think you're right. And I think there's a problem with this one already in that, you know, we've got a lot of sort of general comment along the lines that, you know, Charlie Hebdo was in the tradition of Voltaire and so on. This is the land of the free, et cetera. Interestingly, colleague, friend, very experienced in European affairs, East and West, Tony Barber in the FT, on the FT blog, on his FT blog, said... Charlie Hebdo has a long record of mocking, baiting and needling French Muslims. If the magazine stops just short of outright insults, it is nevertheless not the most convincing champion of the principles of freedom of speech. I'm not saying that, by the way, listeners. This is just a comment from him. And yet you had Simon Jenkins on the Guardian side, as I said, invoking Voltaire. I think, following your question, I just think this is not good enough. I want correspondents putting their name to it really to know something about it. And as I indicated earlier when I was talking about the Americans trying to work out what the psychological complexion of the ISIS command is, you know, that they're standing really back up the road. But I don't think, just to take up a point that I was raising, I probably didn't hammer convincingly enough, was the thing about lone wolves. We hear about lone wolves a lot, all the attacks that we talked about, Sydney, Ottawa, etc., and the murder of the drummer Lee Rigby here in Britain, in Woolwich. Interestingly, I was at a session where there was a former minister who is in the know, who said, actually, that the murder of drummer Lee Rigby, because it was out to get a soldier outside Woolwich barracks, was much more elaborate, they have found, and much longer in the gestation than was generally recognised at the time, even at the time of the trial. So it is a big business. I think it's much more labour intensive than a lot of the security and intelligence services will recognise. And when you've got governments like the UK government and the French government absolutely up against it, wanting to cut everything inside. I think the one thing that Charlie Hebdo has shown up, this is long term. This is the long durée. It will go on for a long time. And therefore, we've got to prepare for that. Unfortunately, I think there is always a tendency to have death by 1,000 political announcements very, very quickly. I think that would be very unfortunate in this case.
Robert Fox and Daniela Pelleda with me here on Midori House. More from them on the incident in Paris today when we come back after this.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour programme packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the US and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, alongside me, Daniela Peled and Robert Fox. Now, France previously has made international headlines with a tough stance on Islamic assimilation, banning the burqa and other face-covering headscarves. There are now plans for anti-Islamic demonstrations this month, similar to those we saw recently in Germany. Daniela and Robert, clearly an issue of, you know, that runs very deeply when we talk about French national identity. I wonder, Daniela, does France, I guess, like some other countries in Western Europe, have a bit of a problem with how it engages with Islam in a very broad way?
I think it's related to wider issues of immigration, and in the case of France, it's also related to the legacy of their colonies in North Africa. It's related to a very, very, very wide and complex web of factors, and I think Islam is just one of them. It's interesting. I just returned from 3 weeks working in Israel, where their view, the very mainstream consensus view on Europe is that it's being Islamified and that Sharia is taking over. And this is a view you hear from very many otherwise liberal left-wing people. I have to explain over and over again that, yes, there are terror attacks and, yes, there are Islamist extremists, but no, I'm not worried. And no, I'm not frightened of my Bangladeshi neighbours. And no, it doesn't really mean anything that Mohammed is the top boy's name in the UK, and this is how the perception is from Israel, and I think amongst the American right as well. And perhaps I am. I mean, I definitely am a woolly, limp-wristed liberal. But when I heard about this attack, as well as being horrified at the nature of the attack and the implications for journalism and freedom of speech and for the massacre in itself, I immediately thought, what about the backlash? What is going to happen next? Because we have seen in recent years and recent weeks this growing move, like Pegida in Germany, of people claiming to be against radical Islam, but this very thinly disguised as basically xenophobia and racism. I find that extremely, extremely worrying. And the problem is when you, as Robert said, try to unpick the reasons and sort of psychological impetus behind this kind of violence, you're very quickly accused of being an apologist. And if you try and say, well, there is a difference between Islam and radical Islamism, again, you come in for accusations that you're just blurring the problem and the liberals are going to be first up against the wall, et cetera, et cetera. I think we have to be very, very, very serious about this, and we really have to fight racism and xenophobia as at the same time we fight security threats.
Well, Robert, let me ask you a bit more about that then, because, you know, clearly people will say, look, there's an increase in populist nationalist rhetoric in Europe. There's an almost obsession, it seems, in a number of countries about the question of immigration. We have porous borders within the sort of EU. What happens next? You know, is there a need for, you know, reassurance that we're better at, you know, monitoring people, hypothetically? You know, do have these people travelled to the Middle East and returned? Of course, it's all just speculation. But some on the right who spread that kind of scaremongering rhetoric will say, well, look, this is an example of where we're not safe, that our porous borders are too porous. Is that of a kind of enduring concern for you, do you think?
Yes, it is, for this reason. I think that we're looking at fragmented and fractured communities, and we're looking at fragmented narratives. For all the stridency of Pegida at times, of Geert Wilders and the like, and we're seeing the same in Scandinavia now, well foretold in the Kurt Wallander books by Henning Merkel, a great liberal tradition, anti-racist tradition in Swedish literature, which has been going on for nearly 20 years, and they've spotted this. But Tom, I think the worrying thing is if we go in for the hand-wringing and the ooh-la-la, we must do something now. Something is fracturing there. As I said, the fractured narrative, we don't know who we are as a nation anymore. It's not only in and around these things, although we see some of the most acute emotions generated about that. But look at the aftermath of the Scottish referendum in the UK. We are seeing, to use computer language, a bundling of a lot of things at the moment, because economic privation, immigration, and focusing on Islam, all people outside Europe, the move across the Mediterranean, and so forth. Where I am critical of the general political debate is that it is so incoherent. The way that the debate led by the Prime Minister in the UK against the United Kingdom Independence Party is based on immigration. Immigration exists. It's going to go on for a long time. We are part of a globalised society which is going to go to between 9 and 10 billion over the next 100 to 150 years. What are the consequences that are going to be of that? People will move. You cannot stop immigration entirely by hard power. We are looking at, we are in the world of Voltaire, at such chop logic, simple slogans and solutions at the moment. Whereas, I said, there is a really long development. If the states are going to defend themselves, defend their communities, which they're so empowered to do, they're going to need a lot of soft power, a lot of cultural intelligence about this, and not the talk, has there been an intelligence slip up? That's what the headlines are going to be tomorrow. And it's almost beside the point. The symptoms that were thrown up by 9/11, by 7/7, yes, there was hysteria about airline travel. There was hysteria after 7/7 about the subsequent plots about fluid bombs and bomb making. But actually, the dynamics of what is going on here is barely being addressed in the public debate at the moment.
Daniela, very
end of rant.
very, very brief final word to you, Daniela. Surely important for France now more than ever to, you know, embrace its Islamic community, to put on a unified front, not just put on a front, but really engage and ensure that it is a unified body. Is that one of the things that you hope are the takeaways from the awful events of today?
I mean, my optimism extends merely to there being not being a rash of vigilance attacks, or there being, you know, the National Front, which is already a pretty popular, increasing its popularity. I think the issues that France has with the Muslim community are very, very complex, and they're driven by economic factors and deep-rooted social factors, urban factors even. And I think it's the work of generations to unpick them.
Daniela Peled and Robert Fox on the shocking events of today. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House 1833 here in London. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll check in with our man in Madrid. We'll meet Massimo Bottura, chef at Osteria Francescana in Modena, and we'll review the highs and lows in the theatre world this week. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news headlines from James Luckhurst.
At least 12 people, including 4 cartoonists and 2 policemen, have been killed by gunmen at the offices of Charlie Hebdo magazine in Paris. A major police operation is underway to find the gunman who fled by car. The euro has fallen to a new 9-year low against the dollar today, with cheap oil driving a bigger-than-expected decline that may prompt the European Central Bank to start printing money. Eurozone consumer prices fell by a worse-than-expected 0.2% annually in December because of a much cheaper energy. Indonesia's search and rescue agency says the tail of a crashed AirAsia jet has been found upturned on the seabed, about 20 miles from the plane's last known location. The discovery indicates the crucial black box recorders should be nearby. Final preparations are underway in Sri Lanka ahead of Thursday's presidential election. 65,000 police officers have been deployed and the army has been placed on alert to provide support if needed. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James. More news from James Lightcaster, full bulletin, of course, coming your way at the top of the hour. That's 1900 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 right now, ticking towards 1835 here in London, 1635 in Rio. Let's check in with another of our correspondents around the world next on the programme. We're heading to Madrid right now. Our correspondent, Liam Aldous, is there, ready and waiting with the top stories of the day. Liam, let's talk first of all about an unprecedented trip to Andorra, I gather.
Yeah, it's very strange that this is the first trip by a head of government, a Spanish head of government, to Andorra. And given that they're very close neighbours, it's kind of odd that the Prime Minister Rajoy would choose today to visit Andorra. But many people are pointing to the fact that there's a very high-profile case, a corruption case and an embezzlement of money case coming up on the 27th of January involving the ex-Catalan Premier Jordi Pujol, who recently admitted to keeping millions of euros in an Andorran bank account. So Rajoy has gone there to basically nut out a deal to share tax information and banking information between the two countries, which basically hasn't never been the case before.
And tell me, what's the reaction going to be to that then? Are people sort of, you know, glad about that, concerned or indifferent? What are people making of it?
A lot of other parties have actually congratulated the Prime Minister. Maybe they've called into question the timing and seen it as a very thinly guised attempt to further incriminate the independence-loving party, CIU. But they're championing the cause, the fact that the Spaniards will be less able to deposit large sums of money into secret bank accounts is largely welcomed. And there was a case just a few months ago when some Catalan politicians were caught crossing the border with around 10,000 euros each in each of their pockets. So this is definitely going to make those little day trips a little more difficult.
I should imagine so. Let's talk a little bit more about how all of this money, the proper budget, Spain's budget, is being allocated. Infrastructure, the beneficiary, Liam, we understand, including high-speed rail. It's very much on track, it seems.
Yes, I like that pun, Tom. The fact is that over the last few years, high speed rail has had had its budget slashed quite a lot. I mean, we even saw Portugal and Spain announce they were going to cancel the high speed rail project between the two countries. But this year, being an election year, the budget or the money allocated to high speed rail is going to be increased by 48%. It's going up to 3.5 billion euros, and we're going to see a lot of stations and tracks open across the country. And it's going to make my job a lot easier because I'm a big fan of the Spanish rail system. I'm going to be able to go to Galicia in record time, Palencia, Burgos, León. I'm going to have to find a reason to go to these places, but a lot of these out-of-the-way inland cities are going to be connected to the high-speed rail network.
Liam, let's move on. It's obviously, you know, the new year is still, you know, only just getting ratcheting up to full speed. Let's look back to New Year's Eve and the New Year's Eve countdown in Andalusia. Tell us a little bit about this one. And I think at one point you can even introduce for us sort of evidence. But tell us about this story briefly, first of all.
Yeah, there was a bit of a catastrophic countdown to the New Year's celebrations in Andalusia. I should set this up and explain that on New Year's Eve in Spain, it's very traditional. Pretty much everyone is gathered in plazas or around TVs, ready or poised to eat 12 grapes as the clock strikes 12. It's a tradition that stretches back nearly 100 years from very questionable origins. But basically, everyone was ready, gathered around their TV screens, especially Andalusia, and then this happened.
Sí, muy atento, pero hay que estar muy atento para no equivocarnos. No nos tenemos que equivocar, ¿vale?
Tenemos el reloj preparado.
Del año 2015 al año 2017, la ciudad de Jerez se convertirá en capital mundial del motociclismo.
So Liam, you got to make sense of that for us. I could hear some, you know, I could hear some striking clock chimes in there. And then what on earth else was that?
Well, basically, as everyone was celebrating the fact that the 2015 had been rung in, people in Andalusia were throwing up their arms in disgust because their broadcast of the 12 chimes had been interrupted in just the 12 chimes with not one but two ad breaks. Basically, it was put down to a technical error or a human error. Someone's even resigned because of it, and there's been a lot of scandal, a lot of controversy, and a lot of criticism at the public broadcaster, saying how did they manage to basically stuff that up in a 12 second countdown, and they managed to put in two ad breaks. And basically, for damage control, they've come out with this two minute clip, comedy themed clip, with the directors of the television channel basically apologizing and stuffing sacks of coal to deliver to the TV station, basically on behalf of incensed viewers.
I'll tell you what, Liam, it would never happen here at Monocle 24. You can rest assured of that. That's our Liam Aldous in Madrid with some of the big stories on his patch this day. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Coming up next on the programme, we'll hear from Massimo Bottura, chef patron at Osteria Francescana in Modena, about some of his favourite things. Stay tuned.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. With bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents, Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, 1841 here in London. Now, over the recent holiday season here on Monocle 24, we brought you a series of special editions of our briefing programme. We invited some of our favourite guests and found out a few of their favourite things. Today we're featuring our chat with Massimo Bottura, chef patron at Osteria Francescana in Modena. He spoke to Monocle's Marco Sippi about some of his most delicious recipes and some delectable music choices that have influenced him during his life.
Let's talk about pasta and beans. It's beans and pasta, working class heroes. It's not blue lobster or caviar. So in this pasta and small glass of pasta and beans, I compress my gastronomic life. What is pasta and beans? Pasta and beans is a stratification process in a small glass in which I compress all my life. Like, the first step is French cuisine, the classics. So I create a crème with a little bit of foie gras, some pork skin and beans that is kind of very deep and really French, so to homage to the Monsieur Ducasse. Then going up, you find like the bitterness of the radicchio with some acidity of the red wine, raised very slowly. We close the glass with a foam of rosemary. So it's my last steps, my last gastronomic steps with the Spanish avant-gardist Ferran Adrià. And, you know, I create this air because I don't like very much the rosemary as an herb because it's too strong. But in the middle, instead of serving pasta in traditional style, I compress, some Parmigiano-Reggiano crust that my grandmother was suggesting to boil into the beans in the meantime you were creating this sauce, because the crust of Parmigiano, they give a beautiful flavor. So when I boil the crust, after that I just load the temperature and I slice them very thin, as it was pasta, as it was the bad cuts, mal tagliati, as we call. So, and I put them in the middle, you know, before adding the hot bean sauce. So at the end, what I did, I compressed between Ferran Adrià and Alain Ducasse, my grandmother. That was the pasta and beans.
That's such an amazing story. And besides, obviously, what you were telling about Ferran Adrià and Alain Ducasse here, what else have you learned from here? Like, do you actually still consult about things with your fellow top chefs, or do you feel like they give something to you, or how would you describe your relationship?
Actually, it's very different between one and the other. Ducasse is still my older brother. And, you know, if you think about that, when he opened Le Maurice and he closed the Place d'Athénée in Paris and he opened Le Maurice, he invited me to cook for the opening of Le Maurice. So it's an incredible relationship. And we're still there. We talk to each other all the time. Ferran is different. Ferran is like my buddy, you know, a friend of mine who opened my mind. You know, all these ideas and, you know, they were like compressed into myself. And at one point I was a bully to learn technique, but I wasn't. I was just realizing that I have to free myself and free my mind to express myself through a Parmigiano Reggiano crust or whatever, or a sardine, better than lobster or caviar.
Let's hear your final recipe choice for today's program now. Supposedly, this recipe has been 20 years in the making.
It's five different age Parmigiano Reggiano in five different texture and temperature. Is a recipe that actually we are talking about Ducasse. Is a recipe that I was creating and I was just playing at that time when in Trattoria del Campazzo, working on Parmigiano Reggiano. But I wasn't so deep into the concept. But I was thinking about myself and my ego. So I was playing with the cheese and the technique. Temperature, texture, and then the recipe evolved till 98, when Umberto Panini is a brilliant man that he was like devoting his life to this cause of the Parmigiano Reggiano. And, you know, he came to the restaurant and I gave him the fourth different age Parmigiano, serving an ice cream. And, you know, at the end of the dinner, he said, listen, it's great, but you have to think about deeper and deeper and think about the aging process. That is the slow passing of time in this region. You know, I'm from Modena, and Modena is in the middle of Pianura Padana in Emilia Romagna, the heart of Italy. And is the land of slow food and fast cars. Is the land of Maserati, Ferrari, Lamborghini, Ducati, you know, but also Parmigiano Reggiano, balsamic vinegar. And, you know, the focusing on the aging process is so important because the time is passing slow. So instead of thinking about how good I was on texture and temperature, I move everything to the cheese. So I start aging the cheese and experimenting on aging the cheese from 24, 30, 36, 40, 50, 60, 70, and understand the whole slowly aging process of the cheeses. So like that, you know, I learn how to create a foam, the bully, of course, the hot gelatin, the air, the fog, everything. And I compress everything in five different texture, five different aged Parmigiano Reggiano in five different texture and temperature. And I think that this is one of the few and the first dishes recipes create with just one ingredient. That was not just one ingredient, but now are five different ingredients, because through the aging process, the ingredients is becoming five.
Celebrating the glories of cheese. Massimo Bottura, chef at Osteria Francescana in Modena, with Monocle's Marcus Hippi. Hearing from Massimo Bottura, let's stay in Italy for our music next. This is M&A with Practical Friday.
Down to the highest bed.
That was with Practical Friday, M&A out of Italy. Ticking towards 1900 hours here in London. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Time for our daily arts review. We're talking about theatre today. A little earlier, Monocle's David Pleasant caught up with our regular contributor and expert connoisseur, if you like, Matt Wolfe from the International New York Times. David began by asking about Bradley Cooper and his rendition of The Elephant Man.
Well, the thing about, first of all, to say about Broadway at the moment is it's teeming with celebrities, much more than London, interestingly. You tend to think of the London stage having lots of stars, but for some reason at the moment they're all in New York, and there are more still to come, including British stars like Dame Helen Mirren. But for the moment, we have Bradley Cooper playing the title role in The Elephant Man. This is a play that's been seen on Broadway twice before, and it's a part of a deformed kind of human freak show, actual man who did live named John Merrick, who Bradley Cooper has been fascinated with. He's been fascinated by this story, fascinated by this character. He's wanted to play him for a long time, and now he finally is at the height of his A-list celebrity. He doesn't have to do Broadway. He's doing it because he wants to, not because he has to. And guess what? His performance is really, really superb. He loves the material, you can tell. He's connected to the material. It's not a showboating performance. He plays the part, although it's marked out by physical grotesquerie. He plays the part from the inside. It's not just commenting on the role, it's being the role. He does a very creditable English accent, dare I say. And
we'll be the judge of that.
Well, thank you very much, David. I realize it's hugely presumptuous of me to even say that, but take it with a pinch of salt. And the way he comes into position as this character, you basically see him wearing, basically looking like a loincloth, like something out of a biblical epic. And then as the character's deformities are described, and there are slides that are shown of the actual John Merrick, Bradley Cooper assumes the position that we're seeing. So you kind of watch the transformation from, you know, rather beautiful contemporary Hollywood film star to period Victorian era freak. And it's very beautifully done.
And he pulls it off.
He pulls it off very well. And one of the things was interesting about it, I'm a great kind of collector of curtain calls. I like the psychology of the curtain call. And I was fascinated by, and I thought it was right, that at the curtain call, although you would expect Bradley Cooper, you know, obviously, to get his own bow and the audience going ballistic, he took a company bow with his fellow co-stars. And it felt like an ensemble event, not just, oh, isn't Broadway lucky to have me?
So now we go on to another big name from the world of music and not so successful.
Yeah, this is Sting and the Last Ship, and I really, really feel badly about this. It's just been announced that the show is closing on the 24th of January at a loss of $15 million. And it's been a sort of grim season on Broadway for musicals. This isn't the only one. There have been others, whereas the plays have done much better. Musicals, of course, are trickier. They tend to cost more. They have to run longer to pay back. This is a show for which Sting wrote the score. It's an original score by him. It's not previous work of his. This is brand new. It's a beautiful score. Even people who don't like the show like the score. And he could well win a Tony Award in June for the score, but it'll be too late if the show's closing in 2 weeks. It's a topic near and dear to his heart about a struggling shipbuilding community in the northeast of England near where he grew up. And it may just be that the politics of shipbuilding in England's industrial northeast may not be what Broadway playgoers want to pay $225 to see.
A little bit niche, maybe, for even Manhattan.
Yeah. Manhattan, surprisingly, can be quite niche. There are times when Manhattan feels very niche when it comes to its theater. I kept feeling watching this, and it's a very smart production by the American director Joe Mantello, very well acted by a cast that now includes Sting. He went into the cast. He wasn't in it originally. He went into it in a supporting role. He plays the foreman of the shipyard, basically to boost the box office, which he's done, but not enough. And he can't stay in it forever. And I think they thought he's finishing on the 24th of January. Once he leaves, that's it. Might as well cut your losses.
Well, poor old Sting with that one. I'm sure he won't. Not all will be lost with Sting. There's always another story with that character.
Sting won't be easily stung.
No.
Sorry, someone had to say that.
Okay.
It had to be me.
We have to rush through the next two big names and big productions.
Well, we'll go very quickly. One is Hugh Jackman in a British play by Jez Butterworth called The River. It was done in London a few years ago at a theater that seats 90 of the Royal Court upstairs. Here, it's a rather bigger theater, a rather bigger star. Hugh Jackman wasn't in it in London. He's good in it. It didn't quite have the feeling of mystery and discovery that it had at the Royal Court with Dominic West, but that could just be, again, the audience has a lot to do with it. And I really felt the audience at Circle and Square had come to gawp at Hugh Jackman and not really to listen to the play. After the play, at every performance, at least during Christmas, New Year's week, he spent, it's quite a physical production, and he wears a t-shirt, which I guess after the show is quite sweaty. And so he auctions off his sweaty t-shirt to an adoring rabid crowd for charity. It's not for his own pocket. He's
Matt, did you buy one?
I would have if I'd had $5,000 to spare, but I deferred to somebody else. It did get bought.
Okay, well, let's move on. If you don't want a sweaty T-shirt for $5,000, very quickly, one last big name from Hollywood, Glenn Close. What's she up to?
Yeah, and I think that's important to mention her because otherwise it just looks like it's a boys' night on Broadway. And Glenn Close is a superb actress. I think 5 Oscar nominations at this point. She's won 3 Tony Awards for her work on Broadway. This is her first show on Broadway in 19 years. It's a wonderful play by Edward Albee, the American dramatist from 1966, called A Delicate Balance, about a kind of absolutely hyper-civilized but wildly dysfunctional family, husband, wife, and alcoholic sister. And Glenn Close plays the alcoholic sister. Good performance, not great. I had the feeling that she hasn't quite got, unlike Bradley Cooper in The Elephant Man, she hadn't quite got under the part, inside the part. She was still, for instance, flubbing her lines. So maybe it just needs a bit more teasing out from her. She will get there, I'm sure. She's a very fine actress.
Well, let's wish her all the best, because I like Glenn Close, and I want her to do well.
I always wish Glenn Close all the best.
That was Matt Wolfe from the International New York Times, talking theatre with Monocle's David Pleasant a little earlier today. That is just about all we have time for on today's Midori House. Special thanks to my guests from earlier in the programme, Daniela Pellard and Robert Fox and Tom Burgess Watson in Paris. Today's show was produced by Ben Rylan and Daniel Giacopelli, research by David Pleasant and Claire Lancaster, and our studio manager was Bill Luty. Next up, after the headlines, it's our weekly business show, The Entrepreneurs. Stay tuned for that. At 2200, the Monocle Daily is here, the Wednesday night edition. Be sure to tune in. This show's back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, as if you needed reminding. But for this Wednesday edition of Midori House and me, Tom Edwards and the team, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.